Somehow, the woods had changed. Ridcully was certain that in his youth they'd been full of bluebells and primroses and bluebells and whatnot and so on. Not bloody great briars all over the place. They snagged at his robe, and once or twice some tree-climbing equivalent knocked his hat off. What made it worse was that Esme Weatherwax seemed to avoid all of them. How do you manage that?
I just know where I am all the time, said Granny.
Well, I know where I am too.
No, you don't. You just happen to be present. That's not the same.
Well, do you happen to know where a proper path is?
This is a short cut.
Between two places where you're not lost, do you mean?
I keep telling you I ain't lost. I'm directionally challenged.
Huh.
But it was a fact about Esme Weatherwax, he had to admit. She might be lost, and he had reason to suspect that this was the case now, unless there were in this forest two trees with exactly the same arrangements of branches and a strip of his robe caught on one of them. But she did have a quality that in anyone not wearing a battered pointy hat and an antique black dress might have been called poise. Absolute poise. It would be hard to imagine her making an awkward movement unless she wanted to. He'd seen that years ago, although, of course, at the time he'd just been amazed at the way her shape fitted perfectly into the space around it, and he'd got caught up again.
Wait a minute!
Entirely the wrong sort of clothes for the country.
I wasn't expecting to hike through the woods. This is ceremonial damn costume.
Take it off, then.
Then how will anyone know I'm a wizard?
I'll be sure to tell them.
Granny Weatherwax was getting rattled. She was also, despite everything that she'd said, getting lost. But the point was that you couldn't get lost between the weir at the bottom of the Lankra Rapids and Lankra Town itself. It was uphill all the way. Besides, she'd walked through the local forests all her life. They were her forests. She was pretty sure they'd passed the same tree twice. There was a bit of Ridcully's robe hanging on it. It was like getting lost in her own garden. She was also sure she'd seen the unicorn a couple of times. It was tracking them. She tried to get into its mind. She might as well have tried to climb an ice wall. It wasn't as if her own mind was tranquil, but now at least she knew she was sane. When the walls between the universes are thin, when the parallel strands of if bunch together to pass through the now, then certain things leak across. Tiny signals, perhaps, but audible to a receiver skilled enough. In her head were the faint, insistent thoughts of a thousand Esme Weatherwaxes. Magrat wasn't sure what to pack. Most of her original clothes seemed to have evaporated since she'd been in the castle, and it was hardly good manners to take the ones Verence had bought for her. The same applied to the engagement ring. She wasn't sure if you were allowed to keep it. She glared at herself in the mirror. She'd have to stop thinking like this. She seemed to have spent her whole life trying to make herself small, trying to be polite, apologising when people walked over her, trying to be good-mannered. And what had happened? People had treated her as if she was small and polite and good-mannered. She'd stick the damn letter on the mirror so they'd all know why she'd gone. She'd a damn good mind to go off to one of the cities and become a courtesan, whatever that was. And then she heard the singing. It was, without doubt, the most beautiful sound Magrat had ever heard. It flowed straight through the ears and into the hindbrain, into the blood, into the bone. A silk camisole dropped from her fingers onto the floor. She wrenched at the door, and a tiny part of her mind, still capable of rational thought, remembered about the key. The song filled the passageway. She gripped some folds of the wedding dress to make running easier and hurried towards the stairs. Something bulleted out of another doorway and bore her to the floor. It was Sean Ogg. Through the chromatic haze, she could see his worried face peering out from its hood of rusty iron. The song changed while staying the same. The complex harmonies, the fascinating rhythm, did not alter, but suddenly grated, as if she was hearing the song through different ears. She was dragged into the doorway.
Are you all right, Miss Queen?
What's happening?
Do you know, Miss Queen, but I think we've got elves.
Elves?
And they've got Miss Tockley. You know, you took the iron away.
What are you talking about, Sean? Sean's face was white.
That one down the dungeon started singing, and they put the mark on her, so she's doing what they want.
Sean.
And Mum says they don't kill you if they can help it. Not right away. You're much more fun if you're not dead.
Magrat stared at him.
"I had to run away. She was trying to get me hood off. I had to leave her, miss. You understand, miss?"
"Elves?"
"You got to hold on to something iron, miss. They hate iron."
She slapped his face, hurting her fingers on the mail. "You're gabbling, Sean."
"They're out there, miss. The drawbridge go down. They're out there and we're in here and they don't kill you. They keep you alive."
"Stand to attention, soldier." It was all she could think of. It seemed to work. Sean pulled himself together. "Look," said Magrat, "everyone knows there really aren't any elves anymore." Her voice faded. Her eyes narrowed. "Everyone but Magrat Garlic knows different, yes?" Sean shook. Magrat grabbed his shoulders.
"Me mum and Mistress Weatherwax said you wasn't to know," Sean wailed. "They said it was witch business."
"And where are they now, when they've got some witch business to mind?" said Magrat. "I don't see them, do you? Are they behind the door? No. Are they under the bed? How strange, they're not. There's just me, Seanog. And if you don't tell me everything you know right now, I'll make you regret the day I was born." Sean's Adam's apple bobbed up and down as he considered this. Then he shook himself free of Magrat's grasp and listened at the door. The singing had stopped. For a moment, Magrat thought she heard footsteps outside the door hurrying away.
"Well, Miss Queen, our mum and Mistress Weatherwax was up at the dances."
Magrat listened. Finally, she said, "And where's everyone now?"
"Dunno, miss. All gone to the entertainment. But they ought to have been back by now."
"Where's the entertainment?"
"Dunno, miss." "Miss?"
"Yes?"
"Why have you got your wedding dress on?"
"Never you mind."
"It's unlucky for the groom to see the bride in her dress before the wedding,"
said Sean, taking refuge in run-of-the-mill idiocies to relieve his terror.
"It will be for him if I see him first," snarled Magrat.
"Miss?"
"Yes?"
"I'm feared about what's happened to everyone. Our Jason said they'd be back in an hour or so, and that was hours ago."
"But there's almost 100 guests and everyone from the town, practically. Elves couldn't do anything to them."
"They wouldn't have to, miss."
Sean went to the unglazed window.
"Look, miss, I can drop down onto the granary in the stable yard from here. It's thatch. I'll be all right. Then I can sneak round the kitchens and out by the little gate by the Hubwood Tower with military precision."
"What for?"
"To get help, miss."
"But you don't know if there's any help to get."
"Can you think of anything else, miss?"
She couldn't. "It's very brave of you, Sean," said Magrat.
"You stay here and you'll be right as rain," said Sean. "Tell you what, how about if I lock the door and take the key with me? Then even if they sing at you, they can't get you to open the door."
Magrat nodded. Sean tried to smile.
"Wish we had another suit of mail," he said, "but it's all in the armoury."
"I'll be fine," said Magrat. "Off you go then." Sean nodded. He waited for a moment on the window ledge and then dropped into the darkness. Magrat pushed the bed against the door and sat on it. It occurred to her that she should have gone as well, but that would mean leaving the castle empty, and that didn't feel right. Besides, she was scared. There was one candle in the room, and that was half burned down. When it was gone, there'd be nothing but moonlight. Magrat had always liked moonlight, up to now. It was quiet outside. There should be the noises of the town. It crept over her that letting Sean go away with the key to the door was not a wholly sensible thing, because if they caught him, they could open it. There was a scream which went on for a long time, and then the night rolled back in again. After a few minutes, there was a scrabbling at the lock, such as might be made by someone trying to manipulate a key held in several thicknesses of cloth, so as not to come in contact with the iron. The door began to open and wedged up against the bed.
"Will you not step outside, lady?"
The door creaked again.
"Will you not come dance with us, pretty lady?"
The voice had strange harmonics, and an echo that buzzed around the inside of the head for several seconds after the last word had been spoken. The door burst open. Three figures slid into the room. One looked up the bed, and the others poked into the dark corners. Then one of them crossed to the window and looked out. The crumbling walls stretched down to the thatched roof, entirely unoccupied. The figure nodded to two more shapes in the courtyard, its blonde hair glowing in the moonlight. One of them pointed up to where a figure, its long white dress billowing in the breeze, was climbing up the wall of the keep. The elf laughed. This was going to be more enjoyable than it had suspected. Magrat pulled herself over the windowsill and collapsed, panting, on the floor. Then she staggered across to the door, which was missing its key. But there were two heavy wooden bars which she slotted into place. There was a wooden shutter for the window. They'd never let her get away with it again. She'd been expecting an arrow, but no, something as simple as that wouldn't have been enough fun. She glared at the darkness. So, there was this room. She didn't even know which one it was. She found a candlestick in a bundle of matches, and after some scrabbling, got it lit. There were some boxes and cases piled by the bed. So, a guest room. The thoughts trickled through the silence of her brain, one after the other. She wondered if they'd sing to her, and if she could stand it again. Maybe if you knew what to expect. There was a gentle tap at the door.
"We have your friends downstairs, lady. Come, dance with me."
Magrat stared desperately around the room. It was as featureless as guest bedrooms everywhere. Jug and basin on a stand, the horrible garderobe alcove inadequately concealed behind a curtain, the bed which had a few bags and bundles tossed on it, a battered chair with all the varnish gone, and a small square of carpet made grey with age and ground in dust. The door rattled.
"Let me in, sweet lady."
The window was no escape this time. There was the bed to hide under, and that'd work for all of 2 seconds, wouldn't it? Her eye was drawn by some kind of horrible magic back to the room's garderobe, lurking behind its curtain. Magrat lifted the lid. The shaft was definitely wide enough to admit a body. Garderobes were notorious in that respect. Several unpopular kings had met their end, as it were, in the garderobe, at the hands of an assassin with good climbing ability, a spear, and a fundamental approach to politics. Something hit the door hard.
"Lady, shall I sing to you?"
Magrat reached a decision. It was the hinges that gave way eventually, the rusty bolts finally losing their grip on the stone. The alcove's half-drawn curtain moved in the breeze. The elf smiled, strode up to the curtain, and pulled it aside. The oak lid was up. The elf looked down. Magrat rose up behind it like a white ghost and hit it hard across the back of the neck with the chair, which shattered. The elf tried to turn and keep its balance, but there was still enough chair left in Magrat's hands for her to catch it on the desperate upswing. It toppled backwards, flailed at the lid, and only succeeded in pulling it shut behind it. Magrat heard a thump and a scream of rage as it dropped into the noisome darkness. It'd be too much to hope that the fall would kill it. After all, it had landed something soft. "Not just high," said Magrat to herself, "but stinking. Hiding under the bed is only good for about 2 seconds, but sometimes 2 seconds is enough." She let go of the chair. She was shaking, but she was still alive, and that felt good. That's the thing about being alive. You're alive to enjoy it. Magrat peered out into the passage. She had to move. She picked up a stricken chair leg for the little comfort that it gave, and ventured out. There was a scream again from the direction of the great hall. Magrat looked the other way towards the long gallery. She ran. There had to be a way out, somewhere, some gate, some window. Some enterprising monarch had glazed the windows some time ago. The moonlight shone through in big silver blocks interspersed with squares of deep shadow. Magrat ran from light to shade, down the endless room. Monarch after monarch flashed past like a speeded-up film. King after king, all whiskers and crowns and beards. Queen after queen, all corsages and stiff bodices, and lappet-faced wow-hawks, and small dogs, and some shape, some trick of moonlight, some expression on a painted face somehow cut through her terror and caught her eye. That was a portrait she'd never seen before. She'd never walked down this far. The idiot vapidity of the assembled queens had depressed her, but this one somehow reached out to her. She stopped. It couldn't have been done from life. In the days of this queen, the only paint known locally was a sort of blue, and generally used on the body. But a few generations ago, King Lully I had been a bit of a historian and a romantic. He'd researched what was known of the early days of Lancres, and where actual evidence had been a bit sparse, he had, in the best traditions of the keen ethnic historian, inferred from revealed self-evident wisdom, made it up, and extrapolated from associated sources. Had read a lot of stuff that other people had made up too. He'd commissioned the portrait of Queen Inchi the Short-Tempered, one of the founders of the kingdom. She had a helmet with wings, and a spike on it, and a mass of black hair plaited into dreadlocks with blood as a setting lotion. She was heavily made up in the woad and blood and spiral school of barbarian cosmetics. She had a 42D cup breastplate and shoulder pads with spikes. She had knee pads with spikes on and spikes on her sandals, and a rather short skirt in the fashionable tartan and blood motif. One hand rested nonchalantly on a double-headed battle axe with a spike on it. The other caressed the hand of a captured enemy warrior. The rest of the captured enemy warrior was hanging from various pine trees in the background. Also in the picture was Spike, her favourite war pony, of the now-extinct Lancre Hill breed, which was the same general shape and disposition as a barrel of gunpowder, and her war chariot, which picked up the popular spiky theme. It had wheels you could shave with. Magrat stared. They'd never mentioned this. They told her about tapestries and embroidery and farthingales and how to shake hands with lords. They'd never told her about spikes. There was a sound at the end of the gallery, from back the way she'd come. She grabbed her skirt and ran. There were footsteps behind her and laughter. Left down the cloisters, then along the dark passage above the kitchens, and past the... A shape moved in the shadows. Teeth flashed. Magrat raised the chair leg and stopped in mid-strike. Grebo? Nanny Ogg's cat rubbed against her legs. His hair was flat against his body. This unnerved Magrat even more. This was Grebo, undisputed king of Lancre's cat population, and father of most of it, in whose presence wolves trod softly and bears climbed trees. He was frightened. Come here, you bloody idiot. She grabbed him by the scruff of his scarred neck and ran on, while Grebo gratefully sank his claws into her arm to the bone and scrambled up to her shoulder. He's just an old soppy, really, from the Nanny Ogg book of cat sayings. She must be somewhere near the kitchen now, because that was Grebo's territory. This was an unknown and shadowy area, terra incognita, where the flesh of carpets and the plaster pillars ran out and the stone bone of the castle showed through. She was sure there were footsteps behind her, very fast and light. If she hurried around the next corner... In her arms, Grebo tensed like a spring. Magrat stopped. Around the next corner. Without her apparently willing it, the hand holding the broken wood came up, moving slowly back. She stepped to the corner and stabbed in one movement. There was a triumphant hiss, which turned into a screech as the wood scraped down the side of the waiting elf's neck. It reeled away. Magrat bolted for the nearest doorway, weeping in panic, and wrenched at the handle. It swung open. She darted through, slammed the door, flailed in the dark for the bars, felt them clonk home, and collapsed onto her knees. Something hit the door outside. After a while, Magrat opened her eyes, and then wondered if she had really opened her eyes, because the darkness was no less dark. There was a feeling of space in front of her. There were all sorts of things in the castle, old hidden rooms, anything. There could be a pit there. There could be anything. She fumbled for the door frame, guided herself upright, and then groped cautiously in the general direction of the wall. There was a shelf. This was a candle, and this was a bundle of matches. So, she insisted above her own heartbeat, this was a room that got used recently. Most people in Lancre still used tinderboxes. Only the king could afford matches all the way from Ankh-Morpork. Granny Weatherwax and Nanny Ogg got them too, but they didn't buy them, they got given them. It was easy to get given things if you were a witch. Magrat lit the stub of candle and turned to see what kind of room she'd scuttled into. Oh, no. "Well, well," said Ridcully, "there's a familiar tree."
"Shut up!"
"I thought someone said we just had to walk uphill," said Ridcully.
"Shut up!
I remember once when we were in these woods, you let me..."
"Shut up!"
Granny Weatherwax sat down on a stump.
"We are being mazed," she said. "Someone's playing tricks on us."
"I remember a story once," said Ridcully, "where these two children were lost in the woods, and a lot of birds came and covered them with leaves." Hope showed in his voice like a toe peeking out from under a crinoline.
"Yes, that's just the sort of bloody stupid thing a bird would think of,"
said Granny. She rubbed her head.
"She's doing it," she said. "It's an elvish trick. Leading travellers astray. She's mucking up my head, my actual head. Oh, she's good. Making us go where she wants, making us go round in circles, doing it to me!"
"Maybe you've got your mind on other things," said Ridcully, not quite giving up hope.
"Course I've got my mind on other things, with you falling over all the time and gabbling a lot of nonsense," said Granny. "If Mr. Clever Dick Wizard hadn't wanted to dredge up things that never existed in the first place, I wouldn't be here. I'd be in the centre of things, knowing what's going on."
She clenched her fists. "Well, you don't have to be," said Ridcully. "It's a fine night. We could sit here and..."
"You're falling for it too," said Granny. "All that dreamy, weamy, eyes across a crowded room stuff. Can't imagine how you keep your job as head wizard."
"Mainly by checking my bed carefully and making sure someone else has already had a slice of whatever it is I'm eating," said Ridcully, with disarming honesty. "There's not much to it, really. Mainly it's signing things and having a good shout." Ridcully gave up. "Anyway, you looked pretty surprised when you saw me," he said. "Your face went white."
"Anyone'd go white seeing a full-grown man standing there looking like a sheep about to choke," said Granny.
"You really don't let up, do you?" said Ridcully. "Amazing. You don't give an inch." Another leaf drifted past. Ridcully didn't move his head. "You know," he said, his voice staying quite level, "either autumn comes really early in these parts, or the birds here are the ones out of that story I mentioned. Or someone's in the tree above us."
"I know."
"You know?"
"Yes, because I've been paying attention while you were dodging the traffic in Memory Lane," said Granny. "There's at least five of them, and they're right above us. How's those magic fingers of yours?"
"I could probably manage a fireball."
"Wouldn't work. Can you carry us out of here?"
"Not both of us."
"Just you?"
"Probably, but I'm not going to leave you." Granny rolled her eyes.
"It's true, you know," she said. "All men are swains. Push off, you soft old bugger. They're not intending to kill me, at least not yet. But they don't hardly know nothing about wizards, and they'll chop you down without thinking."
"Now who's being soft?"
"I don't want to see you dead when you could be doing something useful."
"Running away isn't useful."
"It's going to be a lot more useful than staying here."
"Well, I'd never forgive myself if I went."
"And I'd never forgive you if you stayed. And I'm a lot more unforgiving than you are," said Granny. "When it's all over, try to find Githa Ogg. Tell her to look in my old box. She'll know what's in there. And if you don't go now..."
An arrow hit the stump beside Ridcully.
"The buggers are firing at me," he shouted. "If I had my crossbow..."
"I should go and get it then," said Granny.
Right. I'll be back. Instantly."
Ridcully vanished. A moment later, several lumps of castle masonry dropped out of the space he had just occupied.
"That's him out of the way, then," said Granny to no one in particular.
She stood up and gazed around at the trees.
"All right," she said. "Here I am. I ain't running. Come and get me. Here I am. All of me."
Magrat calmed down. Of course it existed. Every castle had one. And of course this one was used. There was a trodden path through the dust to the rack a few feet away from the door, where a few suits of unravelling chainmail hung on a rack next to the pikes. Sean probably came in here every day. It was the armoury. Grebo hopped down from Magrat's shoulders and wandered off down the cobwebbed avenues in his endless search for anything small and squeaky. Magrat followed him in a daze. The kings of Lancre had never thrown anything away. At least, they'd never thrown anything away if it was possible to kill someone with it. There was armour for men. There was armour for horses. There was armour for fighting dogs. There was even armour for ravens, although King Gurnt the Stupid's plan for an aerial attack force had never really got off the ground. There were more pikes and swords, cutlasses, rapiers, épées, broadswords, flails, morning stars, maces, clubs, and huge knobs with spikes. They were all piled together, and in those places where the roof had leaked, were rusted into a lump. There were longbows, shortbows, pistol bows, stirrup bows, and crossbows, piled like firewood and stacked with the same lack of care. Odd bits of armour were piled in more heaps, and were red with rust. In fact, rust was everywhere. The whole huge room was full of the death of iron. Magrat went on like some clockwork toy that won't change direction until it bumps into something. The candlelight was reflected dully in helmets and breastplates. The sets of horse armour in particular were terrible. On their rotting wooden frames, they stood like exterior skeletons, and like skeletons nudged the mind into thoughts of mortality. Empty eye sockets stared sightlessly down at the little candlelit figure.
"Lady..."
The voice came from outside the door, far behind Magrat. But it echoed around her, bouncing off the centuries of mouldering armaments. "They can't come in here," Magrat thought. "Too much iron. In here I'm safe."
"If Lady wants to play, we will fetch her friends."
As Magrat turned, the light caught the edge of something and gleamed. Magrat pulled aside a huge shield.
"Lady..."
Magrat reached out.
"Lady..."
Magrat's hands held a rusty iron helmet with wings.
"Come dance at the wedding, lady."
Magrat's hands closed on a well-endowed breastplate with spikes. Gribo, who had been tracking mice through a prone suit of armour, stuck his head out of a leg. A change had come over Magrat. It showed in her breathing. She'd been panting with fear and exhaustion. Then, for a few seconds, there was no sound of her breathing at all. And finally, it returned, slowly, deeply, deliberately. Gribo saw Magrat, who he'd always put down as basically a kind of mouse in human shape, lift the hat with the wings on it and put it on her head. Magrat knew all about the power of hats. In her mind's ear, she could hear the rattle of the chariots.
"Lady, we will bring your friends to sing to you."
She turned. The candlelight sparkled off her eyes. Gribo drew back into the safety of his armour. He recalled a particular time when he'd leapt out on a vixen. Normally, Gribo could take on a fox without raising a sweat, but as it turned out, this one had cubs. He hadn't found out until he chased her into her den. He'd lost a bit of one ear and quite a lot of fur before he'd got away. The vixen had a very similar expression to the one Magrat had now. "Gribo, come here." The cat turned and tried to find a place of safety in the suit's breastplate. He was beginning to doubt he'd made it through the night. Elves prowled the castle gardens. They'd killed the fish in the ornamental pond, eventually. Mr. Brooks was perched on a kitchen chair, working at a crevice in the stable wall. He'd been aware of some sort of excitement, but it was involving humans and therefore of secondary importance. But he did notice the change in the sound from the hives and the splintering of wood. A hive had already been tipped over. Angry bees clouded around three figures as feet ripped through comb and honey and brood. The laughter stopped as a white-coated, veiled figure appeared over the hedge. It raised a long metal tube. No one ever knew what Mr. Brooks put in his squirter. There was old tobacco in it, and boiled-up roots, and bark scrapings, and herbs that even Magrat had never heard of. It shot a glistening stream over the hedge, which hit the middle elf between the eyes and sprayed over the other two. Mr. Brooks watched dispassionately until their struggles stopped. "Wasps," he said. Then he went and found a box, lit a lantern, and with great care and delicacy, oblivious to the stings, began to repair the damaged cones.